Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Legacy Leaders Radio.
Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It's that time of the week again. We're going to have Legacy Leader Radio. Mike Quick giving me a hard time.
That's all right, Jack.
We're going
to happens to all of us. We're just going to we're going to glaze past that.
We're going to have a great show today. Before we go on, hey, Mike, let's do a temperature check, man. How's the married life
treating? Married life's is treating me quite well, Jack. My blushing bride is treating me very well.
His eyeballs just rolled.
Don't do that to me, Jack. Don't do that. She might be listening. No, but it's cool. It's going very, very well. We're having a good time adjusting to another person there all the time. And but you know, it's actually kind of nice. We're reading a book. She's reading the book. The Prayful Wife or something like that. I'm reading The Prayful Husband or How to Pray for Your Wife or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going pretty well. So we read a chapter a night. And
have you been required to read the five love languages yet?
I have not, but I'm sure that's in the queue somewhere.
Yeah.
Every time. In the Amazon list.
Yeah. And in my past, every time I've been in relationships and I've had to read the five love languages, it's just a matter of time before I'm done. You know, I've been kicked to the curb because I couldn't interpret the love language. Anyways.
Yeah. What are you going to do?
What are you going to do? You just keep on trying, you know.
That's right.
Hopefully that book will come out and the audio version will probably be better.
Or Cliff Note would be better.
Yeah, Cliff Note version of that. Okay, I know people are going, I can't believe
this. Do they have
guys.
A guest today?
Yeah, do they have a guest?
We do.
Today? We do have a guest. Ladies and gentlemen, we have the awesome Justin Miller from the careforaids.org in the studio today. Justin, talk to us, man.
Jack, to us. Michael, thank you. It's a privilege to be with you on Legacy Leaders Radio today.
Yeah,
I was on this other radio show one time hosted by Michael, but this is really the big time.
This is
the big time.
That was like the interview.
Okay,
for
good.
The bigger interview.
Well, I'm glad I passed.
You did.
that was the JV. Now you're into the
varsity.
Varsity here today for careforaids.org. Well, let me just for my listeners and people that follow the show, Legacy Leader Radio. We discussed this briefly. Is the purpose and the theme of my show is for people that make a difference in the world. It's people that show up and make life better for those people around them who are either suffering or in pain or need help. And when you walk into a room and you leave, people will say, man, I'm really glad that person showed up. I'm glad that person was here. And life is better because of knowing them, having that person's influence in my life. From what I know for careforaids.org, I definitely believe you're one of those people. And so it's an honor to have you as a guest today. And it's a subject that has touched my life and in the past with people who I've known. I think it's a very noble cause, and it's something that definitely we need to be aware of socially and emotionally and also morally in our society. I'm going to just start off. Tell me about careforaids.org and how did you get started and what brought you to here?
That's a very long story, but yeah. I will give you the Cliff Notes version.
We got
of it.
Time.
let me just jump in and just say that I have had many leaders model for me what it's like to be a legacy leader, and I knew growing up that was the kind of impact I wanted to have on this world, but I didn't know in what context that would be. And honestly, HIV and AIDS was the furthest thing from my mind. And when I was 19 years old, I heard a presentation about HIV AIDS and the church's response to it, or more appropriately, the church's lack of response to HIV and AIDS.
All right.
They were, in this particular talk, they were being called to stand up and to lead the rest of the world in caring for those that had been marginalized because of HIV and AIDS.
Mm-hmm.
And even as a 19-year-old, I felt there was something in me that was calling me to pursue this and learn more and ask the question, what can I do? What is my role in helping respond to this global crisis that affects 40 million people? And I had, there was a lot of doubt that a single person could make an impact, but I said, I'm going to take the first step, and that means going to Kenya. So I planned a trip with some peers of mine to go to Kenya to produce a documentary. We believed that was going to be the medium that would allow us to tell our story to the most number of people and have the greatest impact. So at 20 years old, I got on a plane to go to Kenya. My parents were obviously mortified.
I was going to ask you. We'll get to that. Go ahead, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, they threatened us with sending our fathers as chaperones. And so as college students, you know, that was we did not want that.
No, that's like, worst case scenario.
I'm surprised.
Like, no, we're not going to go anymore.
I'm surprised that dad wanted a chaperone going to Kenya in the first place. But yeah.
So mm-hmm. we ended up on the ground. And when we got off the plane, there were two men there that we had coordinated with to be our hosts while we were in country. And their names were Cornell and Duncan. Mm-hmm. And from that moment to today, those guys are kind of the central figures in this story of how this organization was founded and has continued to find success in Kenya. Cornell and Duncan took us around for a month throughout the country as we visited with people at all stages of life and socioeconomic status, from community leaders to orphans and widows, to prostitutes, to doctors mm-hmm. and nurses. And mm-hmm. we just really tried to gain a complete understanding of what HIV/AIDS really was doing into the Kenyan community. And we talked to a lot of pastors as well and said, how is the church responding to this issue? And many were still opposed to, they still had prejudice against people with HIV. And there were churches that were speaking poorly of this issue.
The people of the, or the churches?
The churches.
Churches.
There were many churches that still mm-hmm. held a negative view of this issue, but there were others that wanted to respond, but were ill-equipped to do so.
Okay.
And we saw that there was a great need on so many fronts, but we saw that there was many different services that were being provided. There was care for orphans and vulnerable children. There was medication being dispensed by the hundreds and thousands of doses. There were organizations trying to train people in vocational skills and then finance those projects to help them succeed. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the people that were HIV positive were insulated from all of these different types of care and services, and they couldn't access them, and they didn't have the physical health to be able to work.
They were alienated. Were they alienated?
You
from
can
society?
Isolated, yeah, stigmatized. They were labeled as being prostitutes, and mm-hmm. the women bore the brunt of that that stigma. But they were also, the women were the ones responsible for raising the children.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
we saw woman after a woman who was on the brink of passing away from mm-hmm. AIDS, mm-hmm. and that was happening very quickly, within 2 to 3 years of diagnosis, when in this day and age, the potential for someone to live with HIV can really approach a normal life expectancy. But in order to do that, they have to have access to the right type of care. And we knew that if we could intervene in the life of parents and enable them to live for another 25 or 30 years, mm-hmm. we wouldn't just change their lives. We would create a generational impact, because those parents would be alive to raise and educate their children.
Yes,
they'd be able to teach them about life, about faith, about family, and we would see an effect that would cascade down throughout sure. the generations. And we just felt like all the solutions that we saw in Kenya were really geared towards how do we provide a solution to help these children. And we think that was, and I say solution, I mean, there was a lot of sponsorships, a lot of adoptions, yeah. a lot of orphanages, and those are great. And there's already 1.1 or so million orphans in Kenya. So we have to
it's
respond. It is a big number. That's, I can't even put it really into
Let me ask this real quick
sure.
as we go on here. You saw a lot of positive organizations helping those people that weren't affected by HIV and AIDS. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And there was a large population. You're looking at 1.1 million
orphans.
People, orphans.
Correct.
Orphans.
Closer to 1.6 million adults that were living with HIV.
And when you were on the ground there in Kenya for the first time at 19 or 20 years of age, you could see, it was obvious to you, there's definitely a disparity between those that had or had not, and those that had AIDS and those that did not, and that were thriving based upon the low socioeconomic status of Kenya. Okay, what was your first steps to help those people that were alienated? How did we help them?
Yeah, so I have to give credit to Cornell and Duncan here, because these men had, they were seminary trained pastors. They had been on the mission field for nearly a decade at this point, and they had seen and interacted with people with HIV in all different contexts. And they even lived it out in their own families. And I actually got to meet...
Their family was, were there with them?
No, but we did go and visit their families.
Okay.
And meeting Cornell's mom, who today is about a... she's been thriving for the past decade, when 10 years ago she was on her deathbed giving her last wishes to her son Cornell, and confided in him about her status. And I think this story is relevant because it talks about how we care for them. As a someone who had done a lot of work and understanding about HIV and AIDS, Cornell was able to really rush to his mom's assistance and aid. And she had never confided with anyone. She was HIV positive. If, if you had done that, she feared that, that her children would reject her and that she would spend her final days completely isolated.
Okay, so I wanted to clear this up for our leader, for our listeners here, and,
yes,
and our legacy leaders that are listening here as well. And I was I didn't want to divulge that information, but I, obviously you did with her being HIV positive. Is that correct? So we can use that and go down that path.
Yes,
here.
We can. And, okay, it's okay. only with her
her permission,
okay. and her consent. And
okay, so she confided finally in her son.
She did.
Okay, go ahead.
She did, and she was, you know, giving him the instructions to take care of his six younger siblings that he would be responsible for if she were to pass away. And he immediately was able to get her the medication that she needed.
Yeah.
They had been treating a lot of symptoms, but they had not been treating the root cause.
Sure.
They had, he helped her by making sure that her nutrition was adequate to support the medication she was taking.
Okay.
He provided the emotional support, the encouragement, letting her know that this is not the end. You're not dying. We're going to walk through this together. And her body started to respond. She was able to walk again. She got out of bed. And immediately he helped take some capital and help her start a small business selling fish in the market.
Oh.
So each day she would have something of greater purpose that she could go and she could look forward to and she could aspire to.
And he took care of all the areas of health, didn't he?
Yeah. And
not just physical, but he did mental emotional, social,
exactly.
Yeah. It's spiritual. It's
very multifaceted. And that was just a son responding to this need of his mother. And now 10 years later, his youngest sibling is still in high school. And I know that for a fact that the course of his life was forever changed because his mom was alive. And he didn't have to bear the burden. He would have done it gladly, but the burden of his six younger siblings and having to educate them, feed them, clothe them. And I can say with certainty that Cornell and I would have never met and been able to have this collaboration that we do today if his mother had not been able, been alive.
Regardless of how she contracted the HIV or AIDS, regardless of that, that's neither here nor there. He gave his mother purpose.
That's right.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
that's
so hearing his story, hearing Duncan's story, it's similar but in a different context. I was moved by these legacy leaders. These were guys that I spent a month with, and I left being a better man for it. And they had a vision of how to take what happened with Cornell's mother and figure out how to activate local churches to do a similar model that could reach thousands of people. And when I heard that vision, I knew it was a vision that I was supposed to be a part of, and that God was inviting me to join. And at that moment, even at 19, we had a very humble start as an organization, as all do. But I'm just very thankful that I said, "Yeah, I'd like to join with you, Duncan and Cornell, and use what limited experience and resources and influence I have to try to help this organization thrive."
What's your energy like when you are working with Care for AIDS and you're working in the camps and the groups of people? What's your energy like with them?
Yeah, my energy is, I mean, it's through the roof. I get energized also by being here in the U.S. as well, because I love mobilizing people and resources for this greater good, this kingdom cause. But when I'm on the ground, I mean, it's like I'm sitting here talking to you. Right. I mean, the beauty of it is the people in the
slums. I see the energy in your face. That's, I wish you could see it,
absolutely,
ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah,
I can see it.
When I'm sitting there in the homes of these clients, they're not any bigger than this studio, but they're people with the same hopes and dreams and fears and struggles that any of us here
anybody in the world.
Anyone in the world.
Yeah.
And so we can talk about their favorite soccer team, or we can be talking about the future of their kids' education. But I just enjoy building relationships and really seeing in the people there that they have a great joy that is just, you know, just cannot be shaken. And it's because they're not tied to circumstances or personal gain as ways to value themselves or their identity. Their identity is tied into their community, their family. And that's why getting people with HIV back into a community, other people that are experiencing the same challenges and the same struggles, it's just such a beautiful thing, because that may be one of the single greatest factors that helps save our clients' lives. I mean, the medication's important, food's important, but community for the Kenyan people is so huge.
Without being insensitive, do they see themselves as victims, or do they victimize themselves, or they see themselves with an ailment, but I'm still part of humanity?
Unfortunately, I believe that too many of them have listened to the lies that have been told them about their status.
Okay.
Many of them are victims of men who were unfaithful. It's not always men.
Okay.
So I don't want to generalize too much, but a lot of women have to bear the weight of that.
Let's put it out there. Let's get it out there.
Yeah. But the culture teaches the women that they have done something wrong, or it may be some churches that have told them that they have committed an unforgivable
sin. Because you have HIV and AIDS, you are a horrible person.
You're a horrible person. You're a lesser person.
Yeah, which is totally wrong.
It's totally wrong.
Okay.
And so that's our top priority, is to remind people of their value, their worth, and uniqueness, and what they have to add to this world.
Regardless of what your ailment may be, everybody has value. Everybody has humanity. Everybody can contribute to society in one way, shape, or another. We can probably sit here and talk all day long about people who have had diseases and who have died of diseases, who have been major contributors to our society, to the health of our society as well.
That's right.
I want to hone in on something here, Jack,
if
I may. Yeah. So you started out making a documentary.
That's right.
Just a documentary. Probably what? Maybe 10 minutes long?
It ended up being about 7 minutes, yeah.
7 minutes long. So how did we do this quantum leap from just making a documentary with a bunch of guys in college to starting a nonprofit at the age of, 20?
Now, that was on my list of questions here. So
I took a peek at it, Jack, sorry.
That's a great question.
Well, I think we have to realize, and I would want the listeners to know as well, that I don't know if a quantum leap describes it. I think from where we were 7 years ago, which is hard to believe it's been 7 years, but till today, there is a quantum leap. But it was in the consistent and small steps of just obedience and trying to discover what are the next steps that we take to start an organization.
Right, but even in the thought process here, I mean, like, you're a 20-year-old kid, you're in college,
right.
You've already got plans, you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to be a doctor or whatever, right? And then now it's like, no, I'm going to start. Like, that's a major pivot.
Yeah, it was. And like I said, it goes back to Cornell and Duncan had an incredible vision that I felt so attached to and bought into that I didn't feel like I had a choice but to respond. I felt like I would be doing a great disservice to myself and really to Cornell and Duncan and the Kenyan people if I didn't take something that I had learned about for the first time, I'd become aware of, but I needed to put that into action. And so I decided to start it. But even then, I didn't know what this could become.
Or what you were doing, even.
Cornell and Duncan said, we need about $200 a month to get started. And I said, okay, well, we can make that work.
We can make that work,
We can find a way. I can, you know, scrape together some change, and, you know, I can talk to some churches and some local people. And $200 became $2,000, and we started opening projects and we started seeing lives transformed, and I just got, I got hooked. But even then I said, well, you know, I'll do this for a couple years and then these guys will be able to continue. And I've just gotten so engrossed by the vision and the transformation that's happening that I really can't
see passion,
myself.
There's passion in you.
Yeah, I just can't see myself right now really investing in any other cause than this.
Here's what I find is, I think is just awesome talking to you and watching you here in studio, is that how many 19-year-olds have that passion, have that vision, and then carry and something that's so impactful on our lives and in society. I know they're out there. So if you are standing in a group of a room full of 19-year-olds or young adults right now that want a piece of what you've got in your heart and in your passion, what would you say to them? How would you approach them? How would you talk to them?
Well, I would tell them about my own personal faith, because that's a driving factor for me.
Mm-hmm.
And without it, I'm not sure where my motivation would come from, because it's deeper than just changing lives.
Yeah.
It's deeper than HIV.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a greater eternal need. But I also would talk to young people and say, you see that your age is something that is a real disadvantage. It's something that has to be overcome, you know, your inexperience and your lack of influence and all of that, lack of resources. But I look back and I reflect on this, and I now encourage people to really pursue these dreams and ideas when they're really young. I think that's one of the best times that we can lead. And not every idea needs to be implemented. Mm-hmm. Everything you have to test and seek counsel.
Test the water,
See, does this concept work? And is anyone else doing it? Because it might be better for me to join with them instead of reinvent something that's already been done. And So I would move with caution towards, you know, encouraging every 19-year-old to just go out and start something. We did a lot to, beforehand before we decided to start. But I look back and I see the kind of people that surrounded me as a 19-year-old that wanted to help me succeed. I saw that I had no commitments or obligations. I was in college. I had ultimate freedom.
Yeah,
there was really not a lot of risk involved there. We could have failed, but there wouldn't have been much repercussion for that. And I hadn't let, get out of the workforce for 10 or 20 years. And a lot of people lose their ability to dream these kind of dreams. And so not everyone, but I would just really challenge, you know, young people to, first of all, obviously figure out what they believe in and why they're doing this.
Why are they doing it? Yeah.
Why is a big question. And then after that, I would say, you know, if you've tested it and you're seeing that this concept, then I would just say, go for it. Cause there's really, it's a great time as a young leader to be able to try these things and even fail. And I'm thankful that we didn't, but, it's okay to fail too.
Something tells me that even if you had failed with getting us off the ground, I don't think you would have stopped there. I think you'd have probably kept on finding, okay, this avenue didn't work, so we'll go down to the next one.
I hope I'm
the purpose of learning. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I hope I'm that resilient, and I tell myself I am, but failure is a hard thing.
You had to have had little failures, though, right?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Why don't you share your most memorable failure with us?
Yeah, I was going to ask,
Most memorable failure? Was that a surprise, one of your surprise questions?
No, it's not a surprise question. That was a Michael question, but yeah. That's
all
true.
All Michael questions are surprise questions.
Yeah.
So one of my early failures was we decided that we were going to not only educate our clients how to be successful in their small businesses, but we're going to finance the businesses that we think have merit. And there's nothing wrong with microfinance, but we were not equipped to administer and collect on loans. So we basically ended up giving grants away to our clients because we never saw a penny of that repaid. And it just, you know, the greater scheme of things is a couple thousand dollars, but we used that first year to try things like that and realize, you know what, we're really good at training people on how to do successful businesses, but we're not designed or equipped to finance this. So, okay, we're going to go find a partner to do that. And we started realizing what we're best at, and we've been able to partner with, you know, a dozen different organizations to provide this holistic type of service, but we didn't have to own every single part of it. And then to the failure question, there was a season where we got so into growing that we grew, and we grew too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on me. It's on my leadership to say, you know, the times are good and cash flow is good and we're seeing results. And so we went wild. And I was, you know, 21 or whatever. And we went from four centers to 14 in a pretty short time. And, you know, thankfully there were no really long-term repercussions for the organization, but it put us through a season of having to try to catch up and make things better. Mm-hmm. Because we weren't ready for that type of growth, from a systems perspective, from a finance perspective. And when we got to that point and we finally got to a place where we said, okay, now we're ready to grow again, we've now grown from 14 to 23. And in this season of growth, it has just been a much healthier process.
When you say 14 to 23, you're talking about 14 to 23
HIV? What we call centers.
Centers. Okay.
That's right.
What's in a center?
Well, a center is actually a local church. We use their facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that for a number of reasons. And if you're thinking it from American context, that would maybe not be your first choice if you're trying to reach people across a variety of backgrounds and faiths. I wish more churches were designed to do that. But in Kenya, the church is a very trusted place where people of all backgrounds can come to receive help if that's being offered. It's a very cost-effective way for us to scale and replicate our model.
They're already going there for help, so it just kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
And it's a place where they can feel that their status will be protected, and they'll be protected, so they don't have to disclose it publicly. They can come discreetly to the church.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. So we love that. So that's a center, and really the center is more of a location for counseling. We have two workers at each of our centers that are staffed full-time by Care for AIDS, and they're dedicated to serving 80 clients at a time.
Are these Americans or are they local people?
They're local Kenyans. Okay. We have 60 full-time Kenyan staff that are
employed. Do you have young men and women, or does it make a difference what age they are, from the United States that are missions or missionaries going over there to support you in the Care for AIDS?
We do. We have teams that go on a short-term basis to serve and encourage and equip on about a 7 to 10 day trip.
Okay.
We have one American missionary who will be going to Kenya to live full time in August. And we've had a couple people serve in that role. Mm-hmm. And they're there just to help be a liaison, help host teams that are coming in, and just add a new perspective to the mix. But we'll have one American and 60 Kenyans, and we love that ratio.
How do our listeners volunteer to support and help you in Care for AIDS?
It's a great question, and we would love for them to go to the website and then get a whole kind of list of ways that they could connect with us. And that may mean being a part of an event we do here locally in Atlanta to raise awareness or to raise funds. It could be going on a trip. We do have trips that are open to anyone who's interested, just to go to Kenya, learn more, and get to encourage the people that we work with. You know, we bring our Kenyan directors here to the U.S. twice a year, and hearing Cornell and Duncan speak about that is a lot more interesting than me speaking about it. Mm-hmm. But when they come, we do all kinds of speaking engagements. We could come to your office or your
come
church,
here.
Or we can come back here.
Go to Dogwood.
Yep. Yeah, we can go. Mm-hmm. There's a number of different ways they can help us out, but we. Here in the U.S., besides just being with them in prayer and committing them to that way, really a lot of what they need from us is our resources, because there's not a shortage of talented Kenyans and receptive churches that want to partner with us. And we really need to come together to help them be able to scale this, because that's the vision, is that we're not going to stop here.
I'm going to backtrack just a little bit.
Sure.
Because I take notes when you're talking, and you hit key words with me. Is you mentioned earlier about nutrition, education, educating your clients, patients, what you refer to them as
clients
on social, mental, physical, and nutrition, how to eat right. How important is the nutrition to them for the HIV AIDS process they're going through or their treatment?
it's critical. Okay.
Tell me, the process falls apart
without the nutrition piece. So the medication, like I said, in the last decade has come miles from where it was in terms of effectiveness of treatment. And there's about 30 different ways they can treat different strains of the virus. So it's a very complex treatment process. But it's such a strong medication that if it's taken on an empty stomach, it can begin to erode your stomach lining. It can cause you to react with skin outbreaks or vomiting or things that
just lots of stuff you don't want.
Creates so much discomfort that most people would then stop taking the medication because of the discomfort. And they haven't been trained on why that's happening or what they need to do to remedy it. So when they stop taking the medication, once you've started taking it, you have to continue. If you stop even just for a few days, the virus will mutate and your treatment will no longer be effective and you'll have to be re-prescribed something new. And at some point, I mean, the resources are precious. In Kenya, we have many clients who have defaulted on their medication two or three times and the hospitals refuse to treat them. Because it's just no longer a good use of resources.
Okay. You mentioned partners earlier.
Yeah.
Tell us about your partners.
Well, like I said, we really wanted to stay focused on the things that we did best, and that was really staffing the workers and training the counselors and providing nutrition. But the partners range in so many different capacities. There's the local churches, the 23 local churches we partner with. Mm-hmm. They provide the facilities, and they provide the encouragement and the support. We partner with training organizations that help equip our clients with the skills. Like, for example,
are you at liberty to mention their names or their organizations?
Yeah, sure. They're not a lot that you would necessarily. There are a lot of local Kenyan organizations, but for example, like Equity Bank is a well-known bank in Kenya.
Okay.
They do a lot of the financial literacy training with our clients. The Kenyan Bible Society helps us provide spiritual resources. There are organizations that have partnered with us to help provide food. One down in Orlando, Florida, Feeding Children Everywhere is an organization.
That's a great organization.
It is. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. And they've provided food for us. The hospitals are not official partners, but they provide the medication, something that if we had to provide in-house would make our the cost of our model astronomically high. Mm-hmm. So it's just all these different little organizations that contribute like one piece of the puzzle, but we get to be kind of the ones that aggregate all that together and provide it to clients that otherwise would not have access to it.
Now, one thing that you mentioned is that you have to educate your clients on how to take the medicine and all this, but you probably had to do some educating when you got back home to convince people to help out or kind of tell people about you guys. What are some misconceptions that you had to eradicate on the home front?
Well, unfortunately, I think a lot of the misconceptions are those that are shared with many of the people in Kenya and how they perceive it. We tend to attach this disease to certain communities, and we really just have the belief, as horrible as it is, that these people made a decision.
And they deserve it.
They've got to live with the consequences of that decision. Right. There's other people that have been affected by different diseases or afflictions that are completely innocent. And that's where we should focus our efforts. And so HIV and AIDS is difficult because, one, we don't encounter it as much here. I have to admit, it wasn't until after I started this that I knew anybody that was living with it here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And now I've established a lot of great relationships here, but we don't encounter it. So we have a hard time understanding.
When you say you don't encounter it,
I'm saying we just don't.
The sense of awareness or the fact that we are not acknowledging it. What do you mean awareness?
Kind of both.
Okay.
We don't know. A lot of us don't know anybody personally who's living with it, and they may be managing it so well that we don't really see.
Not an issue.
It's kind of an issue that we've kind of tackled.
You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I feel like that's part of the posture of the whole international community is that if you're not in the work, you kind of feel like we have this thing under control.
Okay.
And that's a misconception.
Sure.
Okay. But, as we work with people here, we have to remind them of, yes, this is still an issue on the global stage that is affecting many, many lives. And and regardless of whose fault it was that they contracted this virus, that's really
the ramifications are still there.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter. We're called to love and to serve and show them compassion, regardless of
and respect to humanity.
Yeah,
respect
and
the
they,
humanity
and
to the,
help them mm-hmm. understand that that value. So for me, it's just helping people understand that, you know, this is a solution. Maybe you don't understand HIV/AIDS, but you understand what an orphan is. You understand the implications of a child being left to fend for himself or herself. And the best way we can care for them is to give them their parents back.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And people understand that a little bit better than what it means to have HIV, the social ramifications of it. But
those kids are and I'm playing devil's advocate here.
Sure, so. Please.
Yeah, but those kids are better off with someone else that doesn't have that or that lifestyle, right?
Yeah, that's not a uncommon perspective, but it's one that we very much disagree with. There are homes that are not fit to raise children, but these parents that we encounter, HIV positive or not,
they love their children.
They love their children.
Yeah.
If you ask them for anything, it's not that, you know, we need a bigger house. We need, you know, something. It says, I want my kids to get educated. Like, that is their number one request.
Yeah.
And that's why we teach them the skills that we do, so they can educate their children.
Now, on the skills that you teach to educate their children, let's go back to Cornell, his mother's relationship, and how he gave her purpose, the fish shop that you mentioned earlier.
That's right.
And you also mentioned a couple of things here, small businesses and microloans. How do you... giving them a purpose and a meaning to get up in the morning, even with HIV AIDS, you help them establish a business. How do you do that? If a family says we want to establish a business, how does that process or protocol work? I think that's I think it's a fantastic and a great idea. I think it's a great concept, great protocol.
Yeah. Well, I think in Kenya, that's really the only option that our clients have to really weigh between. It's either I am able to start my own business, or I can go out and look for just kind of casual labor jobs that hire for the day. But traditional employment is not really an option for many of our clients, because it's about 60% unemployed in Kenya.
In Kenya,
roughly 40 to 60%. So what that looks like is we expose our clients to so many different types of skills, and we try to identify skills that are needed in that community that could allow them to start a profitable business. Mm-hmm. It's hard in these urban communities for there to be a wide variety of businesses, because people don't have the freedom to purchase a lot of like luxury goods or items.
Yeah.
They really are just purchasing the basic goods. But we come in and we teach our clients about basic financial literacy and management. So they need to know how to manage their money, how to save, how to prepare for any future economic shocks. Mm-hmm. We teach them a variety of skills, ranging from how to make types of soaps and detergents they can sell locally. We've taught them how to make different types of food products, including peanut butter, yogurt, these small cakes they make there called mandazi, even candles.
Any chance that any of those products can be exported back to the United States?
It's a great question, and we discuss it often. The challenge is we're going to serve about 2,000 clients this year alone, and we want each of those 2,000 clients, and we have 4,000 graduates. We want all of them to have a sustainable way to earn a living indefinitely, and the kind of market that we could develop here would really only support a fraction of our clients.
Okay.
And it's more important for us that we create an environment where
it's not scalable enough. Or
yeah, I mean, I'm not saying there's not an idea out there that could just explode, but there's really what you don't want is if we started to show favor to a few clients by selling their products.
Yeah.
Every one of our clients would make the exact same product, and all of a sudden we would have saturated the market, and we would not, and all of a sudden our clients would be relying on somewhat of an artificial market that, if that was to ever disappear from the U.S. here, they would not be prepared to support themselves locally.
One thing that I love about what you guys are doing is that you aren't reaching for something that you can't pull back in yet. I mean, you guys understand, look, in order for us to keep helping other people, we have to keep ourselves healthy and ourselves around, because if we overreach and we're gone, then they don't get any help.
That's true.
That's true. That's a common mistake with nonprofits, isn't it?
I think so. I think I made some of those mistakes in the past, as we talked about earlier, but I believe, and I think Andy Stanley uses this term, and it's even been used in Chick-fil-A context, but we've got to get better before we get bigger.
Yeah.
And better before bigger is a big idea for us as an organization, especially because of some of the things we've done in the past. So we talk about that a lot, and we trust that if we're providing the best care to our clients and we're engaging our supporters and donors as best we can, then naturally the organization will grow bigger. But our emphasis has to be on being better.
That's great, and that's fantastic. And I've learned too in my nonprofit world that you don't make an impact on an organization to your second visit. You can show up and promise them the world. It's when you come back the second time, keep your commitments to somebody, is when you start making an impact. Because a lot of people can do a lot of lip service and say they'll commit, they'll promise, they'll do this, but it's not until you come back that second, third, and fourth visit, maintaining and keeping that commitment, is when you start making the impact, I believe. And so obviously you guys are doing that.
We had just this last month, we were opening a new facility in one of the communities in Nairobi. And oftentimes in the beginning, it would take us.
So you're not just in Kenya.
We are in communities in Kenya.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so we are in 23 communities all in Kenya, but the vision is beyond that. The vision is eventually Tanzania. But we had this new center that was opening, and we were going to begin recruiting clients. And in the past, it's taken us maybe 4 to 6 weeks to fill a class of 80 clients in a new community. And we had 65 sign up on day one in a brand new community, which tells us, to your point, that we are now seen as a trusted institution, a trusted provider, where Kenyans know they can get reliable help and that their status will be protected. That's really exciting for us to see.
In your own words, what does a legacy leader look like to you?
I believe a legacy leader is someone who is not concerned about their own gain, their own advancement. They're even not as much concerned about the immediate. They are concerned with creating something that will last beyond them. And that thing that will last could be, it could be an organization. It could be the people that they are able to invest in and leave part of their legacy in somebody else. But it's somebody that I heard Andy Stanley talk recently about what it means to be a beyond you leader. Mm-hmm. And he said a beyond you leader is someone who selflessly and fearlessly empowers leaders around them and those coming behind them. And I think that is when we're using leadership at its highest level. It's about empowering those around us and those to come behind us and creating an environment where they can succeed.
I like that.
Yeah, that's
a good one.
It's powerful, yeah.
Tell me about Atlanta. You had, I saw one of my notes here. It says local events in Atlanta. Tell us about it.
Just the kind of Care for AIDS and what we do here. Mm-hmm. Well, we really just do events that can bring people together under the common interest or banner of what Care for AIDS is doing.
Okay.
Obviously, there's not a lot of direct ways that here in Atlanta we can do things to support our team in Kenya, except for praying for them. We have brought together teams to help write letters of encouragement to our staff and our clients in Kenya, which is one way we can communicate with them and let them know that we're standing with them. But we do other events too. We have a running team of people that will be running the Atlanta 10 miler later this year, and people who just will help us by raising support and making the mission of Care for AIDS known by wearing a jersey and running for the organization. We'll also have a big annual gala this year to celebrate what's being accomplished and to as an opportunity to invite new people.
When is that?
That's October 16th.
Okay.
It's here in the Foundry here in the west side of Atlanta. Our directors, Cornell and Duncan, will be the featured guest of that evening.
That's, they're coming. That's
cool. Yeah, I was going to – okay, I was on mic. Okay, good. Go ahead.
So that's a time where a lot of people can come and experience CareFraise for the first time.
And they can sign up at the website?
That's right. The ticket page is not live yet for that event, but they go on the website. They can sign up for our newsletter. We just send out a monthly newsletter, and we'll be updating everyone soon.
When's
about
the 10-mile?
10-mile is actually at the end of October, so October is a busy month
okay,
for us.
Yeah.
So I believe it's October 25th.
Can I get a T-shirt?
Please, yes.
You got to run 10 miles, Jack.
Yeah, come on.
I'll race you, Jack.
I was going to say, Mike, I'll see you out there when I see you.
All
I'll
right.
be out there when you're out there, buddy.
If you see me running, start. Something's after me.
Yeah, I really would like to get a T-shirt and support you on that, most definitely. Who has influenced you the most?
Well, I think you know the answer to that one. My dad and my mom, for that matter, have been the greatest influences on my life. My dad has modeled for me, I think, what it means to be a legacy leader. He has shown me the kind of husband and father and leader that I believe I want to be. And it's great to have that kind of model to look up to and aspire to. And my mom, it goes without saying that she's right up there with him. She has just been an incredible influence on my life. As you know, my brother has had some, you know, has some disabilities that has caused my family to just have to deal with some challenges throughout the years. But for 24 years, my mom has been the person that's been there to take care of all of those challenges and just be a great mom to me and my brother. And so those are definitely the two people that I aspire to most emulate in my life. And of course, I married a woman that is so much just better than me in almost every regard. And so she continues to challenge me daily and make me a better man and a better leader. So
that's fantastic.
Those are thankfully I just have a family that I can really look up to. There's definitely other leaders outside of my family as well, but those top the list.
I think is your dad listening today?
He's not. He's mm-hmm. out of the country.
Okay.
We'll send him a link.
Yeah, we'll
send him a link. I'm calling my parents after the show.
I want you to make sure you tell dad we said hello pass that message. Go ahead.
Yeah, one funny thing is, remember you asked Mark. We had his dad in. For folks that are listening, we had his dad in about a couple months ago.
Yeah,
Mark asked his dad who he looks up to. Do you remember what his dad said, Jack?
Probably his son.
He said his son.
Yeah.
So
Justin.
That speaks to a whole bunch of levels to your family, which is cool. Yeah. You're all doing some great stuff, and
I think that's fantastic. Yeah. Greatest obstacles you've had to overcome, personally.
Personally, so separate from CareFraise, or
personally,
your personal struggle. I mean, for me personally, that AIDS is scary. I mean, that's mm-hmm. a scary disease. Mm-hmm. How do you overcome that personally with your family? I mean, because you go over there quite often, right? Mm-hmm. That's gotta take some faith, if nothing else, right?
You're exactly right, and it has required me to just constantly be asking myself, mm-hmm. What is it that, why am I doing this, and what are we trying to accomplish? Personal struggles. Thankfully, I have been spared from a lot of challenge and struggle in that way. But doing this work has not come without some cost, and mm-hmm. just. When I decided to set out on this, I had to count the cost and say, am I willing to give myself fully to this mission, knowing that it'll mean being away from my family a lot, probably giving more of my time to this than I would in any other capacity. And it's absolutely been worth every cost that I would have, given to see this vision come to life. But, I have to work that much harder to be the kind of husband I want to be, take care of myself physically. These kind of things are very, being in startup mode has taken its right. toll on me from a physical standpoint, from an emotional standpoint at time, not allowing myself what's needed to rest, and spiritually as well. It can be taxing, and there's a lot of things that come with that as well. So just the joys and the triumphs have far outweighed any struggles that we faced along the way. But there have been those times of doubt and questioning, and just a lot of blood, sweat, and tears put into this to make it a reality.
Ideas to implementation. I'm going to ask you one of your questions.
Yes.
How do you get from an idea to implementation?
Well, I love this concept, and I know a lot of wise leaders who have helped me along this journey to think about this, but I believe that as a generation, we are very enamored by ideas and concepts and things that we think are really neat, but I believe part of what God has given me the ability to do is to think about strategically, how do we move that idea and actually implement it? I hate to see so many ideas fail because of poor implementation. And so taking the balance of our time talking about this issue, as I said, when you have an idea, I mean, obviously, first of all, you have to voice that to somebody, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of ideas that are never spoken. And Bill Hybels, another leader that I look up to a lot, you know, said, you have to have the courage as a leader not to abort the cool visions that God gives you before ever airing those. And so, I mean, a big step in this idea process is sharing them and then processing them and then putting some structure around mm-hmm. it. So, I mean, look at, you know, why are we doing this? What are we trying to accomplish? What resources are going to be required to do this? You know, who's the people or the customer or mm-hmm. the person we're serving? I mean, all the things that go into a normal type of business plan to flesh some of that idea out. And then do a launch. You really launch into it and test it. And for CareFraze, we did about a 12-month pilot of our model. If we had closed up shop after that time, there would have been some loss, but we wouldn't have taken too much risk in doing that. So, you know, at some point, you know, you have to launch and test, and we went through that phase. And then you have to start trying to prove your concept, and that's a fun time as well of trying to figure out, are we having the desired impact that we want to have, and how can we improve it? How can we tweak it? And that was another few years of our process of saying, you know, we want to deliver the absolute best care. Is our board well positioned to help us mm-hmm. Meet this need or grow this organization? And then eventually, if you've tested it and it's working and it's producing the results, then you get to go to scale. And that's a fun place to be. It's a scary place to be. But we're kind of in that scale mode right now, and asking the questions of, you know, how do we do that? Do we replicate this model? Do we try to vertically integrate some of this?
And yeah.
But for me, at that first few steps is critical, and you know, getting it on paper and launching it and being able to, you know, you have to be pragmatic about the success of it, but you also have to be just committed to see it through and weather some of those really hard times and hopefully get to a point where you can actually produce the results that you want to. But it does take some fortitude to be able to withstand a lot that goes on in that startup phase. And most organizations don't make it out of that first phase. But
well, I was going to ask you, my next question briefly would be, if for another nonprofit that's starting up or has a great idea, what insight or advice would you give them?
Well, I would say that they need to seek a lot of wise counsel.
Counsel, yeah.
And it depends on obviously what they're trying to accomplish and where they're operating. For us, this model would not have succeeded without good local leadership and national leadership in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
Internationally, I've seen too many organizations fail because of bad local leadership. And that's a big first step for us as an organization. But the people that I have sought counsel from have made all the difference, and they've helped me avoid pitfalls. They've helped me think differently about issues. Mm. I have one perspective, but it's a limited perspective at best. And so I just need a great board of personal advisors. I need a great board of organizational advisors. And I think you just got to seek that out very early on.
I remember Colin Powell many years ago said that he's not the brightest person when it comes to some things. So you surround yourself with brighter people, or words to that effect. Sorry, Colin, if I got it wrong. But if you don't know something, you surround yourself with those. And I've found that model works for me very, very well. I'm not the brightest spark in the fire when it comes to a lot of things, but so I at least know to go ask.
That's why you have me around.
Yeah, to help me and help me with the things that I'm not that great with. Let me ask you a question. If you walked into a room and they said, "Hey, Justin's coming," and they said, "Well, get ready to play his music," what music or what song, what theme song would you want them to play for you? What would that look like? Ladies and gentlemen, he's squirming in his chair right now, and he's looking around, and he has no idea who's going to ask him that
question. He's looking through his iTunes library.
Don't you ever listen to the radio station? Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question.
Jack, why don't you tell him yours?
Yeah, come on, share some.
I like Raiders of the Lost Ark, Epica. I'm sorry. Pirates of the Caribbean, Epica. The theme music to Pirates of the Caribbean. That's one of my favorites. Okay.
And
what about you, Michael?
My current one right now, and I may be switching soon, but it's still Good Vibrations by Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch.
You think that might be changing soon? That song's been around a long time.
My theme song may be shifting, but for now, it's been around for a while. But that's,
I thought you would be Let It Go for sure.
No.
From Frozen.
No, not me.
But Justin, you're avoiding the issue here.
Oh, I know. This is
Well, here's another one for you.
Okay, give me another one. Right?
You walk into a room as a blank canvas, and somebody said, "What colors would you want on that wall that would represent who you are?" What would they look like?
I don't know. I think the colors. I would say my favorite color is blue. But most people's are. That actually, more people have their favorite color blue, but that's a very generic answer. Mm-hmm. I think it would be a mix of red and oranges and yellows.
Great.
And I have grown to appreciate those colors even more as I have spent a lot of time in Kenya watching just some of the most breathtaking sunsets and sunrises on this planet.
Yeah.
And for me, those colors evoke a lot of emotion that I just love.
Fair.
So that's,
I like that.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
What I would do.
I like that.
Yeah.
As we get ready to close up here, I still would like to know what the song is. However, how do people get a hold of you? How do we support you? How do we help you with Care for AIDS?
The best way that you guys can to connect with us is to go on our website, careforaids.org. Mm-hmm. On that site, you can. You can connect with us on Twitter at CareForAIDS is our handle. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and all that information is accessible on the website. And we'd love for you to, like I said, sign up and get information from us. And anyone is welcome to reach out to me personally. I'd love to continue the conversation. Mm-hmm. And my email is justin@careforaids.org.
Great.
And I would love to... We'd love to continue that at some point.
And let us know how we can support you here at Radio X and Legacy Leader Radio on your mission. I think what you're doing is phenomenal. I think it's fantastic. I think it's noble. There's a lot of passion in what you're doing. We need it in this country. We need it around the world. There's an epidemic out there, and I think it's great people like yourself and the energy you put behind it to help other people and help humanity is what's desperately needed right now. And I applaud you for your organization, for the people that are out there doing what you're doing right now in Kenya. And I think it's absolutely just fantastic. And Michael, anything you want to add?
No, it's been a pleasure to talk to you again, Justin.
Thank you.
It's always great to have you in, man. We'll do it again.
Oh, it's because I love having Legacy Leader Radio shows like this where, in fact, all of my guests have been people who make a damn difference in society. And I've been very blessed and been very honored to have great, great guests on here who make a difference in society. So I've been very, very fortunate with that.
Well, thank you. It's been a great privilege. And I'm curious to ask you though, do you remember what my dad's favorite, what his song would be?
Oh my gosh.
We might've forgot to ask him that one.
He did. I think he had, we'll have to go look. We'll look at that. We'll pull it up here in a little while and find out.
We'll check it out.
Yeah,
well,
we've got it. Yeah, we've got the historical. We'll find out what it is for you.
Well, it not to be too cliche, but you know, the opening music to Lion King would be pretty cool, I think, especially with my love of Africa.
Okay. All right, so we got you.
I'm not going to sing it for you.
No.
I have.
Jack's got a great singing voice.
Many times, so.
Yeah, that's what I got. Yeah, thanks.
And next time on Legacy Leader Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, as we wrap up, we've had the awesome Justin Miller from careforaids.org on the show today. We've had a great, great show. We've had a lot of interaction, a lot of fun, and this is a type of stuff we just love to do at Legacy Leader Radio. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening in today. And Mom, I love you. And we are out of here.